So first of all, thank you all for coming. I know it's been a long day, so we'll try to keep you awake. And thank you very much, Maria, for putting this together and for inviting me. I'm really delighted to have the opportunity to be here. And thanks also to all the organizers of what's been a really great conference. So I will start. "I don't like to waste all my time," Suha exclaimed as she tried to convince a resident of the Bourja Barajneh Palestinian refugee camp in Beirut to start coming to the women's centers, to the women's center sponsored by the Women's Humanitarian Organization, WHO. Visiting women at home was important for WHO's outreach program, and in my research on humanitarianism across the long Palestinian experience of displacement, I went along with Suha on a number of these visits. The negative effects of wasting time were a key part of her overall pitch. Many women in the camp, she said, would sleep until 10 a.m. and then sit around drinking coffee until noon. The center provided a chance for women to make better use of their time and to do something that they enjoy so that they would be more interested in themselves. And the benefits, Suha argued, would accrue not only to the women, but to their children, who would be better raised by a more engaged mother. So there was a double message in her pitch, that participating in WHO's programming could make women both happier and better. And this sort of messaging directed at women is in part a product of the particularities of long-term humanitarian activity. So in circumstances where people's lives are no longer at immediate risk, and situations of such high risk are the natural terrain for humanitarian intervention, humanitarian efforts often turn to improving lives, and that itself is an extremely fraught endeavor in the Palestinian case, and in others as well. But I should also, in some sense, qualify what I just said about the ways in which this is a long-term activity by noting that it doesn't take very long for that kind of immediate focus on saving lives and saving lives alone to begin to expand into other domains of people's lives. So this is just one image among many of a sewing project, sewing class in a Palestinian refugee camp very shortly after the Nakba, the catastrophe in which Palestinians were displaced. So women are frequently the primary targets of humanitarian development projects, a gender disparity that is noticed and often objected to by refugees. And such disparities are not, of course, unique to Palestinians, and Maria referred to this in her remarks, but are found across the humanitarian and development landscape, with women often described as more in need of support because of the presumed patriarchal character of their societies, and as more responsible recipients of aid. Such distinctions are a reminder, in case we still need one, that the humanitarian subject is never, in fact, generic. And I should also acknowledge that while I've framed my talk and given it a title in terms of gender, my focus, much like the humanitarians I was just talking about, is really on women here. But the policies and practices I describe, even when they focus on or center women as a category or women as actors, always have significant effects, of course, on men. So, and even when humanitarian projects seek to reach across a gender divide, it is not always possible to distribute attention equally. So an MSF mental health project that I followed in Bourja Barajneh, for instance, included a number of activities: educational outreach about mental health conditions, group sessions, and individual therapy. And MSF intended the project to reach both men and women, and there were male patients in therapy. But due mainly to women's greater availability, a lot of its programming, and especially kind of the group activities, was focused on women. In group sessions, social workers were attentive to the particular stressors on women that could lead to mental health challenges. So in one session I attended, the social worker asked the women gathered how many had time for themselves, and no one said they did. She then talked about the pressures that this situation causes and the impact that it has on women and on their relations with others. She described the physical manifestations of mental health issues and urged women to seek mental health treatment when their doctors tell them that nothing is physically wrong. So in offering suggestions for how women might cope with the stress of their lives, the social worker focused on relaxation techniques. "Go to a room by yourself," she began one such lesson, at which point a woman interjected to say, "I don't have a room to myself." But Mona was not deterred. "Go to the balcony or onto the roof." So always seeking some way to create a space for this. And I heard from everyone I talked to in my research that the lack of privacy exacerbates all the problems of life in the camp, and women suffer acutely from this absence. So as Suha's comments about women's tendency to waste their time that I began with indicate, the focus on women in humanitarian programming can be a double-edged sword, and it can come with a lot of judgment about how they are living their lives. And all of this occurs in the context of pervasive concern about the possibly corrosive effects of living with aid. And you hear this from everyone kind of caught up in the aid apparatus, humanitarian providers, but also recipients as well, even as kind of the facts of people's lives, I think, belie this concern. So this kind of messaging further indicates that women are never addressed solely as individual subjects, but always in relation to the effects of how they live for society as a whole. And in this regard, the gendered analyses of humanitarian development continue a long tradition about the broad social effects of improvement in the status of women. And this discourse is found across the humanitarian field. So again, just to use an image to give a window, very quick window into another aspect of the humanitarian field, I began with an image of a sewing class or under sort of ICRC auspices, right? So major international humanitarian organization. This is an image from much more recently from my field work in the Gaza camp in Jordan, and this is at the Islamic Center, which is a Muslim Brotherhood-supported center that provides aid and assistance to women in the camp. So there's a very similar kind of messaging from the range of different actors who are engaged in humanitarian work, relief, and development directed towards women about the impacts of their improvement for society and the effects of the problems that they face on themselves and on society. So attention to being better people and living better lives may seem an inappropriate focus for humanitarian activity. So to return to this idea that it is generally thought about as being about saving lives. But in fact, the boundaries between humanitarian relief efforts and development transformation efforts are never as clear-cut as people, including many practitioners, imagine or seek to maintain. And this is especially true in circumstances of long-term displacement and long-term need. So in researching 70 years of Palestinian displacement, beginning in 1948 with the Nakba catastrophe that dispersed and dispossessed the majority of Palestine's native inhabitants, I have sought precisely to understand what happens to humanitarianism as it becomes long-term. How do humanitarian providers and recipients respond to chronic conditions as much as crisis situations? Whenever humanitarian activity stretches out over time, planners and field workers are forced to confront the limits of its orientation to the present. With its mission as crisis response, right, with the goal of saving lives and moving on, humanitarian actors often try to focus on needs that are both urgent now and that can be addressed now, rather than on planning for change. Though, again, as I've already said, that's basically impossible. And humanitarian interventions frequently have short mandates and temporary funding streams, limiting their planning horizon. So, for example, UNRWA, which is the main UN agency that provides relief to Palestine refugees, no one imagines, until actually maybe now, as the Trump administration is seeking to undo their funding, nobody has imagined that they're going to go away anytime soon, but their mandates have always been 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, right? So even though it's a long-term organization, it has a short-term mandate. And also it should be said that humanitarian emergencies rarely end on schedule. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees has estimated that 2/3 of the global refugee population experience protracted displacement. So scholars, practitioners, and publics all have to confront the fact that long-term humanitarian presence is not exceptional. And the Palestinian experience with long-term humanitarianism is in many ways paradigmatic. And this is another thing that I always try to emphasize when I talk about this experience. The Palestinian experience in a range of ways is often described as exceptional, right? Sui generis, the conditions that led to this problem are unique. The politics of the circumstances make it so different from other conditions that we can't think about it comparatively or we can't take lessons from it. But in fact, while of course, like any circumstance, there's a lot that's unique about it, and I'll talk about some of the things that are unique, it is an excellent window through which to understand the dynamics of post-war humanitarianism, precisely because all of the twists and turns in humanitarian practice in the post-war era have been experienced here. And it's on kind of an extreme edge of longevity, but as I said, long-term humanitarian presence is the norm, not the exception. So in considering this experience, I've been investigating both the politics of life and the politics of living in humanitarianism. So the humanitarian politics of life includes the operation of the humanitarian apparatus, right? The categories that define humanitarian subjects, the procedures that govern humanitarian practice, and the decisions that humanitarian actors make on the ground. And this entails not just a general attention to the welfare of populations, but also a politics of distinction that, as Didier Fasson puts it, entails deciding the sort of life that people may live or may or may not live. So even as humanitarian actors might disavow the sort of prerogative of that distinction and those decisions, their work enacts it at every turn. And in global discourses of humanitarian compassion, women are more easily legible as victims deserving succor. But in the regulatory practices of humanitarian assistance, gender decisions produce multiple, sometimes contradictory effects. And in talking about the politics of living, I mean the ways that people survive and strive within humanitarian spaces. Aid recipients make concerted efforts to maneuver within humanitarian spaces to try to achieve better outcomes for themselves, their families, and their communities. And these efforts require and mobilize considerable analysis of humanitarian principles and practices. Like the politics of life, the politics of living has transgenerational effect. And such politics is pursued in part despite humanitarian restrictions, which include an insistence on political neutrality and the effort to create and maintain a humanitarian space apart from the political field. But it's also advanced in and through humanitarianism, which in fact offers mechanisms through which refugees act politically and a language in which they press claims. And as with the politics of life, gendered thought and action can have contradictory effects in the politics of living. The kinds of ascriptions and judgments that come along with humanitarian attention to women are part of the politics of life, right? Particularly the politics of life as aimed at the fixing of value. For humanitarian service providers, refugees are often defined in the seemingly contradictory nexus of the apolitical victim and the improving subject. So from this perspective, the right way to live as a refugee can be to always be preparing not to be a refugee. And this transformation is often understood to require both becoming an object of development and achieving self-reliance. And a central challenge to that project posed by life in a Palestinian refugee camp, especially but not only in Lebanon, is that material improvement may be impossible. Given the significant limits on opportunity, products of legal restriction on employment, and political refusals of access, a lot of the development work in camps concentrates on helping people cope better with their circumstances, and so a mental health project kind of fits into that, or on improving their character, and some of the activities of the Women's Center sort of fall under that rubric. But this fixing of value, the description and delineation of the good refugee subject or the good refugee woman is never the whole story. Attention to the politics of living highlights the contestations over such calculations within recipient communities that are central to humanitarian experience. Such contestation sometimes happens through direct resistance and through the articulation of a different set of values. But it also happens when refugees work with and within an apparently fixed framework in order to transform their worlds. So gender is a category that structures humanitarian decisions and distinctions and shapes how people live within and against this apparatus. Just again, to give you a little bit of a sense of some of the ways in which people are living within. So I talked about the problem that's often talked about idleness within the humanitarian apparatus. And when you look at the kinds of things that people have to do to be a recipient of aid, idleness is not really, in the early days, there's really no opportunity for idleness. And this is for men and women as well. But the rations that people got was flour that people had to then make into bread, right? You're not simply receiving that you can then sort of live on. And then this is one sort of quick window into some of the ways in which people act politically with and within the refugee category, sort of using rations cards as a symbol for claim making and other tools of humanitarianism. So I want to go sort of in some sense back in time to look at some of the foundational categories and procedures that have shaped what humanitarianism has been for Palestinian refugees, and specifically the refugee category and the what governs access to it. So I'm turning, in some sense, from the question of how to live right as a refugee from the questions about who will be recognized as a refugee at all. And the question of eligibility, both for inclusion in the Palestine refugee category and for eligibility for rations and other services as a registered refugee, has been a perennial problem in the Palestinian case. And forgive me that I'm going to put up this slide and basically not explain most of it, because I don't have time and because it sort of takes us beyond what I'm focusing on. But what I want to highlight to you, and you can sort of look around at some of the things, is the kind of complexity that goes around the sort of basic definition that's at the center of what constitutes a Palestine refugee to all the possible ways in which people might fall outside of the category, either because they are non-eligible refugees or they have genuine need, but they don't qualify for the category. And what I want to talk about actually is this over here, women married to non-refugees, MNR. And the context for some of these problems is that there was limited finances and therefore always limits on the number of refugees who could be on the ration rolls. So there's never a context in which it's just if you are a refugee, you can be on the rolls, right? There's a limited number. And so there's, from the beginning, categories of distinction about how to make decisions about who might be a refugee doesn't get to be on the refugee rolls. And one of the ways in which those distinctions were made was that registration was done by the household, by the head of household, and the ration cards were by family. So when women married, they would go onto the card of their husband if the person that they married was a refugee. If the person that they married was not a refugee, they were removed from the roll. So they lost their refugee status by virtue of their marriage. And then, of course, their children did not get refugee status because it would descend through the male line. And of course, these kinds of decisions were contested. So for instance, in 1960, the director of Syria's refugee office wrote the UNRWA representative in Damascus to complain about the removal of MNRs from the ration rolls, saying it is not acceptable for humanitarian and logical considerations to deprive a needy refugee of rations simply because of her marriage. And UNRWA's response was basically like, well, if you can get some other people off the rolls, maybe we would consider it. But even as the inequities from the MNR policy were evident for a long time, patriarchal underpinnings of UNRWA's registration rules made it hard to resolve. Right? And so in its 2004 annual report, basically what UNRWA said was, we know that there is a problem here, but the rules are a throwback to a time when, and they sort of placed the blame outside, personal law in this area favored the male lineage. But since then, norms have changed considerably, and moreover, the international community has since spawned a number of international conventions, resolutions, World Conference declarations, and programs of action which promote the gradual elimination of all forms of discrimination against women at the local, national, and international levels. So gender remains a central category of analysis here, but its terms have shifted. right? From explicitly patriarchal with reference to somebody else's cultural norms to a rights-based language of equity and anti-discrimination. And we can talk in questions if you want about this, some of the work that's being done in locating the agency for thinking about these decisions. And in fact, UNRWA has now taken up a protection mission, which it didn't originally have, which makes gender-based violence part of its area of concern. And eventually, this MNR policy was changed. Some of the language for making the change has to do with this language of equity, but what actually makes it possible is not simply that, though there's a change in focus, but that by the mid-2000s, there's a view that not that many people are going to actually take up the resources that would come to them by being allowed to register. So it's never just about a gendered view of the world, but in this case, a gendered view of the world intersecting with a particular, very concrete set of financial concerns about the consequences of the change. I had a story about the ways in which Palestinian women sometimes sort of maneuver through this landscape of registration restriction to try to get themselves and their families on the rolls, even when it's not permitted. So just know that that happens. And I will conclude by saying that efforts to overcome obstacles in the way of access to humanitarian categories and services, whether the obstacles come from humanitarian procedures, such as the MNR policy, or social and family decisions, are a central part of the politics of living in humanitarianism. And so too are the variety of ways that people try to work around the limits of these categories and services. So women were the primary protagonists in many stories that I heard about selling rations to get a more varied diet, tailoring donated clothes to make them more appropriate and desirable, and remaking shelters to create more privacy. And the circulation of these stories is itself part of the way in which gendered narratives of refugee value are fomented and sometimes challenged. Thank you.